content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we'll start today with The Flu Is That Bad. This was written by Catherine J. Wu. The flu situation in the United States right now is, in a word, bad. Infections have skyrocketed in recent weeks, filling hospitals nearly to capacity. Viral levels are high, or very high, in most of the country. In late December, New York reported the most flu cases the state had ever recorded in a single week. My own 18-month-old brought home influenza 6 days before Christmas. He spiked a fever above 103 degrees for days, refusing foods and most fluids. I spent the holiday syringing electrolyte water into his mouth while battling my own fever and chills. This year's serving of flu already seems set to be more severe than average. Seema Lakdawala, a flu virologist at Emory University, told me. This season could be a reprise of last winter's, the most severe on record since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, or perhaps worse. At the same time, what the U.S. is experiencing right now fits within the general spectrum of what we would expect. Tyson Bell, an infectious disease and critical care physician at the University of Virginia Health System, told me. This is simply how the flu behaves. The virus is responsible for one of the roughest respiratory illnesses that Americans regularly suffer, routinely causing hundreds of thousands of people to be hospitalized annually in the U.S., tens of thousands of whom die. So far this season, the flu has killed more than 5,000 people, including at least 9 children. Influenza is capable of even worse, sparking global pandemics, for instance, including some of the deadliest in history. These current tolls, however, are well within the bounds of just how awful the, quote, seasonal, end quote, flu can be. It's another flu year, and it sucks, Bell said. Although flu is a ubiquitous winter illness, it is also one of the least understood. Scientists have been puzzling over the virus for decades, but many aspects of its rapid evolution and transmission patterns, as well as the ways in which our bodies defend against it, remain frustratingly mysterious. Flu seasons, as a rule, differ drastically from one another, and we don't have a great deal of understanding of why one ends up being more severe than another. Samuel Scarpino, an infectious disease modeling researcher at Northwestern University, told me. Experts' flu DAR has also been especially out of whack in recent years, since the arrival of COVID-19 disrupted the typical flu transmission patterns. An entire lineage of flu, for instance, may have been driven into extinction by pandemic mitigation measures. The virus is still finding its new norm. Even so, a few things about this season's ongoing torment are clear. Much of the blame rests on the season's dominant flu variant, subclade K, which belongs to the H3N2 group of influenza. As flus go, H3N2s tend to be more likely to hospitalize and kill people. Most of the worst flu seasons of the past decade in the U.S. have been driven by H3N2 surges. Subclade K doesn't seem to be an unusually virulent variant, which is to say it's probably no more likely to cause severe disease than a typical version of H3N2. But it does seem to be better at dodging our immune defenses, making the net effect similar because it can lead more people getting sicker than they otherwise would. That's not a trivial effect for a disease that, even in mild cases, can cause days of high fevers and chills, followed by potentially weeks of that delightful run-over-by-a-truck feeling. At UVA Health, Bell has seen a major uptick in people testing positive for the virus in recent weeks. Like others, his hospital is close to full, straining its capacity to treat other illnesses, he said. In Michigan, too, where Molly O'Shea cares for children at multiple pediatric practices, we are seeing a ton of influenza, just a ton, she told me. Our schedule is overflowing. Several of her school-age patients have wound up in the hospital, despite being previously healthy. A few have ended up with serious complications, such as pneumonia and brain inflammation. The worst cases, she said, have been among the children who didn't get their annual flu shot. Flu vaccines are not among the most impressive immunizations in our roster. Although they're generally pretty effective at protecting against severe disease, hospitalization, and death, they don't reliably stave off infection or transmission. And they're frequently bamboozled by the virus itself, which shapeshifts so frequently throughout the year as it ping-pongs from hemisphere to hemisphere, that by the time flu vaccines roll out to the public, they're often at least a little bit out of sync with what's currently circulating. That's another aggravating factor this year. Researchers first detected subclade K in June, months after experts selected the strains that would go into the fall flu vaccine formulation. Recent data suggests that vaccination may still elicit some immune defenses that recognize subclade K, and preliminary estimates from the United Kingdom suggest that this year's formulations may be especially effective at preventing severe disease in children who, along with the elderly, are highly vulnerable to the flu. For all the misery my family endured, none of us ended up in the hospital, which suggests that our vaccinations did their job. Children also tend to be the biggest drivers of flu spread. They are the source, many times, of explosions of transmission, Lakdawala told me. In the UK, for instance, which experienced an unusually early start to the flu season, school-age kids appear to have driven much of the epidemic, Scarpino pointed out. In the U.S., too, case rates among children have been particularly high. Although the vaccine primarily limits severe disease, it can also affect how quickly the virus travels through a community. And yet, only about half of American kids get the vaccine each year, despite long-standing universal recommendations for annual immunization. It's a vaccine that parents have never really treated as a vaccine that every child should get, O'Shea said. Those choices might be influenced by the ways many people underestimate the flu, a term often used to describe any cold-weather ailment that comes with a runny nose, cough, or even gastrointestinal upset. In reality, the flu has long clocked as one of the U.S.'s top 10 or 15 causes of death, a scourge that, though its impact on the healthcare system, the workforce, and the economy at large, costs the country billions of dollars each year. Against such a substantial threat, we should be using everything in our toolbox to protect ourselves, Lakdawala said. Yet the Trump administration is actively impeding the process of flu vaccination. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has also said that it may be a better thing if fewer people are immunized against the flu, and insisted, incorrectly, that there is no scientific evidence that the flu vaccine prevents serious illness, hospitalizations, or death in children. The federal government recommended annual flu vaccines for all children until earlier this month, when HHS pushed through changes that demoted multiple immunizations from its recommended schedule. HHS now says that families should consult with their health care provider before taking the shot. Such a recommendation suggests that the vaccine's overall benefits are ambiguous enough to require discussion and puts an additional burden on both patients and health care providers, who can administer what was once a routine vaccine only after a conversation that must then be documented. The nation's leaders have also compromised one of the country's best chances to develop more effective, better-matched flu vaccines in the future by defunding research to mRNA vaccines. The current flu vaccine manufacturing process takes so long that the included strains for the Northern Hemisphere must be selected by February or so, which provides plenty of time for the virus to evolve before the autumn rollout begins, as happened this year. We pretty regularly have a bad match for the flu, Scarpino said. mRNA vaccines promise the possibility of faster development, allowing researchers to stay more closely on the flu's heels and switch out viral ingredients in as little as 2 or 3 months. That degree of flexibility would also have sped the response to the next flu pandemic. In an email, Andrew Nixon, HHS's Deputy Assistant Secretary for Media Relations, disputed the characterization that the department's new policies impede flu vaccination, writing, "Providers continue to offer flu vaccines, and insurance coverage remains unchanged. The recommendation supports shared clinical decision-making between patients and clinicians and does not prevent timely vaccination. People can continue to receive flu vaccines if they choose to do so." For the current season, much of the U.S.'s fate may already be sealed. Less than half of Americans have gotten a flu vaccine this season, while the virus continues to spread. If you find yourself in a place where there are people sick with flu, you're probably going to get sick, Scarpino said. That logic likely holds true for his own family in Massachusetts, where flu activity has been high for weeks. They've so far made it through unscathed, but Scarpino said, "I feel like it's just a matter of time." Our second story. Is the Iranian regime about to collapse? This was written by Karim Sajapour and Jack A. Goldstone. 47 years ago, Iran had a revolution that replaced a U.S.-allied monarchy with an anti-American theocracy. Today, the Islamic Republic of Iran may be on the verge of a counter-revolution. History suggests that regimes collapse not from single failures, but from a fatal confluence of stressors. One of us, Jack, has written at length about the 5 specific conditions necessary for a revolution to succeed: a fiscal crisis, divided elites, a diverse oppositional coalition, a convincing narrative of resistance, and a favorable international environment. This winter, for the first time since 1979, Iran checks nearly all 5 boxes. In the past week, protests have engulfed Iranian cities, their momentum growing daily. These began as a response to a fiscal crisis, a national currency in free fall, a state with empty coffers. In American politics, inflation rates of more than 3% tend to bring down administrations. Iran's inflation rates, more than 50% across the board, 70% for food, are among the world's highest. Over the past year, Iran's currency has fallen more than 80% relative to the dollar. In 1979, a single U.S. dollar was worth 70 Iranian rials. Today it's worth 1.47 million rials, a depreciation of more than 99%. Iranian currency has become less a medium of exchange than a daily index of national despair. And unlike past economic crises, this collapse has crossed all class lines, affecting bazaar merchants and the well-off as well as the poor. Iran has 92 million inhabitants, perhaps the largest population in the world to have been isolated for decades from the global financial system. In addition to inflation, the country suffers from endemic corruption, mismanagement, and brain drain. Young Iranians contend with high rates of unemployment and underemployment. Older generations have found their pension funds to be largely insolvent. Renewed global sanctions and the dwindling price of oil, down 20% in the past year, have forced Tehran to sell its oil to China at a backbreaking discount. Power outages and water rationing have become fixtures of daily life. The second condition for state breakdown, the alienation of the elite, is also widely evident in Iran. What began in 1979 as a broad ideological coalition has, by 2026, contracted into a one-man party, the party of Ali Khamenei. Mir Hossein Mousavi, a founding father and the former prime minister of the Islamic Republic, is in his 15th year of house arrest. Every living former president has been silenced or sidelined. Mohammad Khatami is under a total media ban. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is marginalized and monitored. Hassan Rouhani was barred from seeking a seat in the 88-member assembly of experts, the clerics who choose the next supreme leader. The regime has been hollowed out by decades of negative selection, the result of rewarding mediocrity and prizing ideological loyalty over competence. The effect has been to alienate the professionals and technocrats who once provided the state with its administrative backbone, replaced by sycophants and suffocated by the clergy's interference in daily life. This class has long since lost faith in the system. It sees its wealth eroded by inflation and the country ruined by incompetence, a failure now undeniable in the mismanagement of Tehran's water supply. Much like the Soviet Union in the 1980s, the Islamic Republic has mostly lost its convictions. Only a small percentage of its insiders remain true believers. The majority are motivated by wealth and privilege. One Tehran-based political science professor we spoke with put a finer point on this. At the beginning of the revolution, the regime was 80% ideologues and 20% charlatans. Today, it is the reverse. Bazaar merchants played a pivotal role in the 1979 revolution, serving for years as a core constituency and economic base for the Islamic Republic. But in recent decades, the regime has built the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, into a military-industrial complex from which networks of wealth and power flow. Siamak Namazi, an Iranian-American businessman held hostage by the regime for 8 years, compared the Iranian state to a collection of competing mafias dominated by the IRGC and its alumni, whose highest loyalty is not to nation, religion, or ideology, but to personal enrichment. This system has not only weakened the regime's ideological cohesion, but also displaced the traditional merchant class, turning the bazaar from a pillar of support into a source of dissent. Still, one group of elites remains united, the country's security forces. Their solidity has until now prevented the Islamic Republic's collapse. No senior IRGC commanders have defected, as yet, or voiced even mild public criticism of Ayatollah Khamenei, despite years of nationwide protests and targeted Israeli assassination of nearly two dozen senior figures in their ranks. For many of these commanders, losing power would mean losing wealth and potentially their life. They would likely be the last leaders to turn against the regime. But if they did, the regime would not survive. Iran clearly meets the third criterion. The Islamic Republic's political, economic, and social authoritarianism has created a diverse oppositional coalition in response to perceived injustice. Over the past decade, intermittent mass protests have drawn participants from virtually every socioeconomic class, including ethnic minorities on the periphery of the country, labor movements, women, and bazaaris. These groups have rarely coordinated their efforts or protested in unison, but many of their reasons for outrage are broadly shared. The Islamic Republic is a theocracy that claims to rule from a moral pedestal. For this reason, examples of its graft and hypocrisy are particularly galvanizing. IRGC commanders oversee the brutal enforcement of the veiling of women. but their daughters and mistresses are spotted overseas without hijab. The country is suffering from a severe water shortage, and many Iranians believe that a, quote, water mafia, end quote, linked to the IRGC is diverting resources to their own industrial projects, while entire villages are left to die of thirst. The children of thousands of senior officials advertise their lives in Western cities on Instagram and LinkedIn. Protesters in the city of Yazoo recently chanted, "Their children are in Canada. Our children are in prison." The opposition movement has shown that it can mobilize widespread fury, but to succeed, it will need to move beyond mobilization and forge links with disgruntled elites. Some of these technocrats and marginalized insiders feel alienated, but are too afraid to act because of what may await them the day after. The opposition needs to offer a credible, safe exit for these regime insiders, convincing them that the Islamic Republic is no longer their shield, but their shroud. Revolutions arise when rulers become weak and isolated, when people believe themselves to be part of a numerous, united, and righteous group that can act to create change, and when political elites begin to attach themselves to the people, abandoning the government rather than defending it. In Iran thus far, the last ingredient has been missing. The fourth condition for state breakdown is a convincing shared narrative that bridges a nation's socioeconomic, geographic, and ideological divides. In Iran today, the regime's founding principle of pan-Islamic revolutionary ideology has been supplanted by a fierce corrective nationalism. The state's shop-worn mantras of death to America and death to Israel are being drowned out by a demand for national self-interest. Long live Iran. This is not merely a change in tone, but a total rejection of the regime's regional adventurism, punctuated by the now ubiquitous protest chant, "No to Gaza, no to Lebanon, my life only for Iran." Beyond a surge in nationalism, Iranians have grown immune to the hollow ideological slogans and performative piety of a self-appointed moral state. A population largely born after the 1979 revolution seeks, above all, zendegi-e-normal, a, quote, normal life, liberated from a regime that micromanages people's attire, intimacy, and private choices. By delegitimizing the Islamic Republic as an occupying force, one that plunders national wealth to subsidize regional proxies, the opposition has effectively subverted the regime's nationalistic rhetoric. Every successful revolution requires both inspirational and organizational leadership. Many of the protesters in Iran's 2026 uprising have rallied behind former Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, who has lived in exile since 1979. Leading an opposition from exile and restoring a deposed monarchy are both daunting, but neither is unprecedented. Vladimir Lenin in Russia, Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, and Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini in Iran all spent more than 15 years in exile before returning to lead revolutions that toppled the regimes that had banished them. Several countries that once abolished their monarchies, including Spain, Cambodia, and Britain under Oliver Cromwell, later restored them as constitutional monarchies. As Iranians know well from 1979, ruthless contests tend to define revolutions. Having spent nearly half a century abroad, Pahlavi has not yet organized the on-the-ground muscle needed to prevail in such a contest. He also faces a deeper question. What kind of order do Iran's monarchists aspire to establish? Pahlavi has consistently said that his goal is to help Iran transition to democracy and perhaps to serve as a constitutional monarch if chosen by the people. Yet many of his most passionate supporters are vocal about restoring an absolute autocracy. This tension has inhibited his ability to flip disaffected elites against the regime. Yet ironically, among the broader population, this ambiguity could work in his favor. Revolutionary ideologies need not provide a precise future to unite and motivate their followers. On the contrary, what often works best are vague and utopian promises of deliverance, combined with an emotionally powerful depiction of the intolerable injustice and inescapable evils of the current regime. The final and decisive catalyst for revolution is an international environment that helps sink the regime rather than bolster it. After North Korea, Iran may be the most strategically isolated country in the world. Over the past 2 years, since Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack on Israel, which Ayatollah Khamenei alone among major world leaders openly endorsed, Iran's regional proxies and global allies have been decimated or deposed. For decades, Tehran projected strength through its so-called Axis of Resistance, a network of nearby proxies and autocratic allies. But following the devastating 12-day war in June, that deterrent has been degraded. With Hezbollah's and Hamas's leadership in disarray and Israeli jets maintaining a humiliating, virtually uncontested presence over Iranian airspace, the regime is strategically naked before its people, exposed by an empty treasury and an unprotected sky. When the five conditions coincide, economic strain, alienation, and opposition among the elites, widespread popular anger at injustice, a convincing shared narrative of resistance, and favorable international relations, the normal social mechanisms that restore order in a crisis are unlikely to work. Society's equilibrium has been profoundly disrupted and can easily tip into escalating popular revolts and open elite resistance, producing a revolution. The Islamic Republic is today a zombie regime. Its legitimacy, ideology, economy, and top leaders are dead or dying. What keeps it alive is lethal force. The most important element still missing from a full revolutionary collapse is the repressive forces deciding that they too are no longer benefiting from, and hence no longer willing to kill for, the regime. Brutality can delay the regime's funeral, but it's unlikely to restore its pulse. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.